claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
November 9th, 1989. History is made. The Berlin Wall falls. Years pass. Decades end. A new century is born. In 2021, one wall remains at Revolution Radio. The wall between Studio A, the Wisdom Circle, and Studio B, the Raw Deal. The wall falls. History is made. Wisdom Circle plus Raw Deal equals the event. James Fetzer, David Scorpio, Giuseppe Bafangolo. History is made. And now, the event.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, who's simply delighted to be back on this special occasion from coping with a health crisis that really laid me flat. I've been out of action for roughly 2 weeks, but nothing could gladden my heart more than to be on today with our special guest and to be joined by Giuseppe Vaffangulo from the Wisdom Circle. Our guest today is a completely brilliant student of JFK, 9/11, a host of other issues. We've collaborated in many instances, including a brilliant photographic portfolio of what happened at the Pentagon. He was a leading electronic troubleshooter for the Navy until he resigned and went to work for Raytheon. He knows a great deal about what's going on from A to Z. Before I introduce him by name, however, let me mention a significant development within the 9/11 truth community that occurred a few days ago. Richard Gage, who had been the chair of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, has resigned. Now, there are those who think that's unfortunate and bad, but I celebrate it as very good news. Richard Gage was leading a limited hangout with architects and engineers where they would only focus on how the event had happened, will not even talk about who was responsible and why, and gave a false accounting of how it was done using nanothermite, where, among other points, he and architects would not even talk about who was responsible and why, in the absence of which historical framework, none of this amounts to more than technical gobbledygook to most Americans. He focused on Building 7, characterizing it accurately as a controlled demolition, but we'd already learned that from Dan Rather on 9/11. So in my book, Richard Gage disappearing from the scene is a giant step forward, including that he had a battery of those attempting to defend the idea that a plane had actually hit the Pentagon, which is a crucial central issue, because as the American Command and Control Center, if a plane did not actually hit the Pentagon, we know the whole 9/11 scenario is fraudulent. I'm now pleased to bring in Dennis Camino. Join the event, my friend. We're so glad to have you here.
Well, he's unmuted, so we should be hearing him.
Well, given his background in electronics, I would think Dennis would be able to sort this out. Though he also has a phone number where he could call in to Mitchell. Dennis, you could call in to Mitchell, and we can hear you that way, even keeping your image up.
Let's see. What did he say in the private chat? Okay. He asks, is my mic working? So no, it's not, Dennis. Okay, he's gonna try the phone then. Mitchell, he's gonna
Very good. Giuseppe, I'm just so delighted to have you back with me on this special occasion.
Yeah, Jim, tell us a little bit about what did you get hit with, a type of flu experience? What happened?
Well, I was very curious, Giuseppe. It began with some chills on a Wednesday. Then I had a repeat on a Friday where I wrapped myself in a blanket. But Saturday morning, I felt very, very weak. I had difficulty getting out of bed. I had a low fever, virtually no cough, but it was very debilitating. During the course of these events, I'd be briefly hospitalized twice, once for 7 hours, once for eight, and avoided the vax. But before I knew it, they'd done the rapid, and no doubt, therefore, I'm one more statistics for the rampant pandemic across the nation, which you and I both know, as we've reported many times, is a complete hoax. In fact, in my opinion, even more monstrous than 9/11. Dennis, do we have you? Mitchell.
Oh, he's Mitchell. He's calling Dennis now. Yeah, Jim, I mean, I think I still have that shocking graphic. Here we go. There you go, Jim. Essentially, you're describing a flu, right? And this whole, it blows my mind. What is COVID?
Telephone number 503-964-57.
He didn't get it. I guess he'll try again. But, you know, it's insane, this whole scamdemic trying to rebrand. Literally, if you look at the screen, the 2019, 2020, 38 million cases of the flu, 2021, 1,822, because now everything's COVID. And so if you take that on face value, then what these Satanists have done is released a gain-of-function bioweapon that's making people sick, to drive people to getting this deadly jab, this experiment on genetic manipulation, which it should be illegal and shouldn't be occurring in any capacity. And yet, man, it is dark times, disturbing times these days.
Mitchell, any luck? Has Dennis reached you, or can you reach him?
Well, he tried calling once, and then, I don't know, did you hear that?
I was calling him, he was calling me.
Oh,
now he's with us right now.
All right, how about now?
There he is.
Dennis, we can hear you now. We can hear you now, my friend. We're so pleased to have you here, and you've done such brilliant work. Give us, let's say, start with a Pentagon, because in my opinion, once you blow apart the Pentagon, you realize the enormity of the hoax.
Well, the Pentagon thing is you realize what took place is that there was no, for the first 8 minutes after the event, there was no wreckage on the lawn. I think she was a Spec 5 or Spec 4 in the Army, took her camera out, took some really good photography outside. Is completely bereft of any airplane wreckage until quite a few minutes later. There was an F-15 Eagle driver that took off from Andrews and circled the Pentagon and examined it from the air, and he noticed that there was no wreckage visible at all, any place around the front of the Pentagon or anywhere around the Pentagon. He reported back that there was no wreckage, and then of course, you guys probably remember Jamie McIntyre, who at some point during the morning events there, just shortly after everything started, he was looking at the Pentagon and reported he saw no wreckage. So there was a number of reasons why Pentagon didn't work until the FBI agents that were on site started to grab wreckage from the front of the Pentagon and take it out and placed it in the lawn. And we have photographs of them, which we've published in articles on Veterans Today and other venues that where we did the articles about Pentagon fakery. So it's quite clear that there was no 80 to 100 tons of aircraft wreckage April Gallup, who was working in the Pentagon that morning with her kid, and was knocked out cold when an explosion occurred, knocking her backwards and hitting her head and knocking her out. She carried her son out through what was supposed to have been the aircraft impact hole, and she didn't encounter any airplane wreckage. She didn't encounter any wiring. She didn't encounter any jet fuel. She didn't encounter pieces of bodies, seats, luggage, overhead bins, any of the interior of a Boeing 757 either. So they got a major problem with the fact that they reused wreckage from an American Airlines crash in December of 1995, where an aircraft, the pilots were tired. They'd been flying for quite a number of hours. They plugged in the wrong navigation fix for the final approach into the airport. And unfortunately for them, there was another fix in the system. By the way, a lot of these fixes are five-letter designators that are alphabet designators that the FAA uses. And they usually have a name that's associated to something in the general vicinity around the airport. And if these pilots were not really familiar with the history there, they probably wouldn't have noted that the name that they plugged in was for a fix that wasn't even co-located. And the system, the FMS system, should have rejected it because it wasn't in the area. But that they didn't have the proper fix, and they started to descend. The unfortunate fact of life is when the ground proximity warning system went off on their aircraft, the one mistake that they made during the recovery and the climb out is that they failed to retract the spoilers, and the spoilers were still deployed. So the sink rate was high, and they slammed into the mountain. I mistakenly had said during my Pentagon presentation, my 9/11 presentation in Vancouver in 2012, that there was only one survivor. That really wasn't true. A couple people survived, I think a total of six. But that wreckage was recovered by an Israeli company that got permission from the carrier to go into the Columbia jungle and recover it. And because Boeing was concerned about the reuse of aircraft wreckage, they were aware of the fact that the Israeli company had gone in there and recovered it. And the assistant United States attorney, a man last name of Cole, who was in the Seattle area, was investigating this. And he was murdered exactly 1 month to the day of 9/11 for investigating the Israeli company having access to this wreckage and recovering it and taking it out. So that's the wreckage, which has been positively identified by a number of aircraft experts that knew how the paint scheme on American Airlines jets had been altered to where the word American in the front of the aircraft was in different locations. And this, I think it was Flight 595 that crashed in Buga. Its paint scheme matched the A that was in the rivet line that was found on the lawn at the Pentagon, which was still with a piece of jungle vine that's only indigenous to that particular jungle that's outside Buga. So we've ascertained that the Israelis got permission and recovered this wreckage. They went so far as to send a Mossad assassin who was identified on the scene using a Tokarev pistol that shot the assistant U.S. attorney who was investigating it. Of course, once the United States government realized that the Mossad was involved in killing the Aussa, as we call them, that was investigating this whole thing, they dropped everything because they realized they were dealing with America's best friend, which is ironic. But we know where the wreckage came from, and we know that the United States government to this day won't talk about where they stored it, because the unique thing about aircraft parks is there's things called trailing documents that follow an aircraft through production, and virtually every major part and component is documented in a file as it's put on the aircraft. Parts from this aircraft that went down in Buga in December of 95 would easily be in documentation that Boeing still had it in its indices, which by now has probably been completely grabbed and scrubbed by the FBI, who obfuscates and covers up all major crimes since the JFK assassination. So we know where the wreckage came from, and we know that there was a huge dearth of, you know, lack of thereof of wreckage from the Buga crash. Because obviously it didn't make any sense that they'd bring all 80 tons of it. But they would drop, you know, the smaller pieces and put them there. The ironic thing was that the aircraft engines were not recovered. They were probably left in the jungle because they didn't have plans to bring them. But what this means is that the Israeli government had had a plan. They had no constructive reason to go into the jungle in Buga and grab this wreckage of all the different aircraft crashes that had occurred around the world and bring it with permission from the United States government for staging at the Pentagon on 9/11. So we know which aircraft wreckage is used. It wasn't November 644A's wreckage, who obviously would have different trailing documents that would prove that all the components found at the Pentagon were wrong. They weren't the right parts. But one of the most striking reasons why we know the Pentagon wreckage wasn't even the same genus or possibility is that when they planted the flight data recorder at the Pentagon, the one that they used was a digital model, which really didn't come into the production string until several months after 9/11 occurred. In other words, the tape model that was on the airplane that crashed in Buga was a Sunstrand Model 700, and that's what should have been found because the November 644A was in the same production cycle approximately that the airplane that crashed in Buga was, and it wouldn't have had a digital flight data recorder. Would have still been using tape, and that's what they planted. And we can talk about the incongruencies in wrong things with the flight data recorder, the missing aircraft ID and the missing fleet ID number in the preamble, which is always stored within the unit and written to the memory in what's called a PIG, or protected encapsulation. So there's any number of reasons why we know that the plane that crashed there wasn't the one. A plane spotter saw November 644A, the American plane that allegedly was involved, Flight 77, I think in a New York airport, several days after the event. So it was in one piece and intact. So there's a bunch of reasons that we know that they planted the Buga wreckage. They murdered a United States attorney to cover up the investigation into the recovery of the wreckage by Israelis, which, in my opinion, is pretty dank and dark. By the way, there were a number of articles in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer about this investigation. They've been scrubbed so that you can't even find them anymore, but I downloaded them and kept them. So the family, of course, probably was aware of what their, you know, the son and daughter probably aware of what their dad was working on when he was murdered by the Israeli Mossad agent that came and shot him. He was sitting at his computer composing something when he was murdered through a window with a Tokarev that they shot him with, a stock weapon of assassination choice for Israeli Mossad agents, by the way, especially coming from Europe, which is probably where the guy came from. The picture looks exactly like what you would expect a piece of scum from Haifa or from Tel Aviv to look like, or any place in the Ukraine for that matter, where they garner these guys. But anyway, to cut it short, they reused wreckage from the Buga crash, which on impact didn't really burn violently because a lot of the aircraft fuel was expended in the flight to Colombia. So that's why a lot of the wreckage is bereft of burn marks on it. There's a number of parts that would have been prominent. The engines would have been there because they would have been in the building, by the way. They would have penetrated the Kevlar jacketing probably a number of meters into the building. They didn't show up until several hours later. There's no wing penetration slots where the wings would have gone in. According to a shill and a CIA operator named Michael Rivero, also named as John Wankus, who is one of the alleged victims on the flight, by the way. He has a couple of different names that he goes by. He lives in Hawaii. according to him, the plane hit so hard that it demolecularized and turned into subatomic particles from the impact force, which, of course, is so ludicrous that it's insane, because if you've seen any aircraft crashes, there would have been predominantly mostly tail and wing and, you know, large empennage, fuselage portions there, and of course, a plethora of body parts spread all over, including inside the building, and there just wasn't. There are a number of pieces of wreckage, by the way, that were moved around, which is something you never do, even at a site like this, where they took part that was part of the area around the wing route that was intact from the Booger crash. And they moved it from interior by the blowout ring, which you've seen in photography, and then they picked it up and carried it out, put it out in the front lawn, and you know where it moved. And then there's no reason for it to have been moved except for the fact that they wanted to stage it because it was a fairly large piece. But they were missing approximately, I'd say, 79 tons of airplane wreckage. It just wasn't there, and it wouldn't have been demolecularized per Ribeiro's bullshit. And by the way, there would have been bodies all over the place. In other words, there weren't a lot of people in the aircraft, according to the official list, but there was enough to where when April Gallup crawled through the hole where the aircraft entered, there would have been, you know, viscera everywhere, guts, you know, bone, you know, fragments of hands, feet, you know, major limbs. It would have been a charnel house. You would have never possibly forgotten it. And the thing that's most amazing is that jet fuel, most people are not familiar with Jet A, what it looks like when it comes out of an airplane in a crash, if it's not consumed in a fireball, which it couldn't have possibly all been, because it had a lot of fuel on board, probably 5,400 gallons on board the aircraft on impact. The issue with the airplane was that jet fuel would have been everywhere. It would have been on the lawn. It would have been on the facade of the building. It would have been on the in the soil inside the building. It would have had such a very powerful jet fuel stench everywhere. Nobody recovered or recalled that they smelled it. The only thing that was stated is that they smelled what smelled like cordite at the Pentagon crash. We'll talk about what made the hole and stuff if we get into it. But I want to reiterate once again that the Israelis recovered this crash wreckage with obvious permission, and the U.S. government signing off on this months in advance. They didn't just go into the Booga jungle and grab this stuff and hustle it to the United States. It took a lot of preparation to go over, get permission from the government, bring it over here, and then by the time that the people that Boeing got wind of the fact that there may be counterfeit parts being sold, because it's forbidden to reuse crash or wreckage as resaleable parts for any number of reasons, because of the stresses that are involved when aircraft impact the ground or other aircraft. It damages them in ways that may not be apparent. It causes stress cracking if they're intact. It weakens the structure of a lot of metals, and if it's an instrument or anything from any panel that survived, which it wouldn't have, would have been destroyed. It was marketed again as a used part from a flyable aircraft. It probably wouldn't have been something that you'd want to fly in any aircraft with. So there's a good reason for Boeing to be concerned. There's a good reason for the assistant U.S. attorney to be investigating it, because at the time there was a growing and burgeoning problem, predominantly with recovery and reuse of wrecked aircraft parts. So we have a trail that the United States government has fastidiously tried to cover up, just like in 1963 with the JFK murder. In this case, they bent over backwards to cover up the murder of one of their own, which is so reprehensible and disgusting. It's off the scale of disgusting. But they killed an assistant United States attorney in Seattle to cover up the Israeli recovery. So anyway, I'm going to turn it over to you guys and let you comment now.
Those were great points, Dennis. Yes, all four of the alleged commercial planes on 9/11 were only about 25% full in the case of 77, which turns out to not have even been in the air that day. Allegedly 64 aboard when they could carry 289. Before I turn this to Giuseppe, let me ask would it not have been the case that everyone at the Pentagon, everyone present that day knew this was a hoax and a fraud on the American people? Wouldn't they have all known? And by the way, cordite, for those who are unfamiliar, is a common military used explosive.
Well, I thought that Giuseppe was going to jump in there, but apparently not. Anyway, the cordite, you know, if you remember the photography about what they had for the Pentagon, there was a hole in the C-ring that there was a marking around where the hole was, and it was marked blow out, which is pretty amazing that they actually still left that marking there and didn't obliterate it. At least I would have gone over it with a power washer to make sure people couldn't see it in photography. But there's no way in hell that a Boeing 757 would have penetrated that deep. The airplane is basically a frangible aluminum tube. It's not that structurally substantial to go through a Kevlar-reinforced wall, which that section of the Pentagon had been previously reinforced by the by DOD and predominantly evacuated because construction was still ongoing on 9/11. So the claims about the casualties at the Pentagon, I think, are BS because the paucity of the number of people that are sitting here. By the way, the official Navy story, which is obviously floated by the CIA, was that all the financial data about like $2.1 trillion that was missing from Pentagon budget that Rumsfeld talked about was all being kept in naval computers by naval investigators and the section that was destroyed, which is amazingly convenient, isn't it, that the part of the Pentagon that you've chose to hit and you went to the extent of executing more than a 270-degree turn to strike it after you visibly lost it, and we'll talk about that in a bit, you know, lost visual contact with it, which a pilot wouldn't have done, because if you've ever flown into D.C. Coming in from any number of directions, you can't possibly not see the Pentagon on a crystal clear day like that for more than 25 miles from altitude. In other words, it's very distinctive. It sticks out like a sore thumb. Washington Monument is right there for orientation. There's lots of easy-to-spot landmarks where even if you're unfamiliar, you know what the Pentagon looks like. You know what the Washington Monument looks like, for God's sake. You might not see the White House, although you really can. All kinds of reasons why you shouldn't have lost it, but there's a reason why they lost it, because they weren't flying in the Boeing 757 when they struck the Pentagon. They were flying a Global Hawk, which was going to launch an AGM 65J model Maverick, which just entered the U.S. Navy's inventory in about May of 2001. And it had a depleted uranium warhead on it, which is a very unique item. And it would have been a requisite to pre-test the weapon like this when it enters the inventory. And I think that the Pentagon was configured on purpose, that one wing, specifically to test the capabilities of the AGM-65. In other words, the whole thing was so pre-staged in so many different ways that there were no subsequent plans to reinforce the other sections of the Pentagon, just that section that they intended to hit, which was ultimately predominantly evacuated for the most part with almost nobody in it because it was under construction. So we have a lot of reasons to really smell the rat that they went in there with the intent to test, weapons on 9/11 amongst other agendas that they had, but they took great advantage of it. By the way, the AGM-65 worked great, but when it detonated on the impact with the wall, a lot of the depleted uranium warhead blew back in the blowback area right in front of the Pentagon and created a massive depleted uranium contamination issue, of which Pentagon people that were on site had to be decontaminated from because it was detected with radiac equipment that was on site. So they started to wash people down and stuff, and then ultimately later, the United States government went in there with a huge amount of aggregate to dump on the ground to cover up the DU signature, because you would have been able to go in there with a meter and find the pieces that were big enough to really let you zero in on them, and then you could recover them. By the way, people have gone in there and taken samples underneath the aggregate that they dumped. They didn't lay it down 3 feet deep. It's only 5 or 6 inches deep because they were so cheap they didn't buy enough. But So you can actually get down to where the DU is actually at, because as most people don't understand, granite actually has its own radiation signature, and it masks the signature of depleted uranium enough to where if you were going in there from the top and trying to find the chunks of depleted uranium from the explosion on 9/11, you'd have a hard time doing it unless you dug in or drove probes into the ground to take samples that way. So they took extraordinary measures to cover up the depleted uranium. And by the way, there's only one aircraft, to my knowledge, commercial airplane that uses depleted uranium in any of the surfaces of it, and that's the DC-10 MD-11 transport aircraft, a passenger airplane that is long ago, probably even before 9/11, really kind of ceased to be in vogue. And if there was any depleted uranium, it would have come from anti-flutter weights in the horizontal stabilizer, and there wouldn't have been enough of it for them to drop all that granite to mask the signature of it. So they had to get rid of the signature of depleted uranium because it was a telltale sign of the use of a militarized warhead to blow the hole in the outer wall, and that's where it's at. So anyway, I'll let you pick it up, Jim.
I think those are all wonderful points, Dennis, and it seems to me to confirm my belief that everyone at the Pentagon at the time knew this was an elaborate fraud. And I wonder what kind of impact that had on morale when so many understood that the American public were being played and the U.S. military was right at the heart of it.
Well, you know, when they went to the hospital to talk to April Gallup when she was recovering from her injuries that day, and U.S. government agents basically told her repetitively over and over again what she was to believe and what she was to say publicly. And she refused to do it. And she's made a number of different interviews since 9/11 where she vehemently cited the fact that that they just told over and over again, dictated to her what she was supposed to talk about, what she's supposed to say. And she knew what she didn't see when she crawled through that hole with her son. She didn't see airplane parts, body parts, anything. There would have been miles of wire everywhere inside the point where the plane went through. By the way, if you look at pictures, there's a giant piece of concrete structure hanging down, not swinging down, but still intact right in the hole where the plane apparently penetrated, what they said. There's no way that an airplane traveling at the speed that they said it was, which is impossible for that altitude. They said it was doing 465 knots on impact, which it wasn't. Couldn't possibly achieve that. But if it was doing 465 knots, the hole would have been big enough for the plane to penetrate, and it wasn't. And there would have been no concrete structure hanging down right in the very center of the penetration orifice. So there's a lot of big problems why the story is so ridiculous. But for it to penetrate at that altitude, the engines on the way in would have had to dig trenches. And most people aren't familiar with what ground effect does on an aircraft, but when it's within a half wingspan of the ground, especially an airplane traveling at such ridiculous speed like that, if it was even controllable at all, which it really wouldn't be, but there's no way that the horizontal stabilizer would be able to overcome the outrageous lift vector that would lift it out of ground effect from that speed. In other words, an airplane going fast wants to climb. Unless there's reasons why it can't, but at 465 knots, it would have so much surplus lift that the minuscule, in comparison, horizontal stabilizer wouldn't be able to overcompensate for all that lift, and they wouldn't be able to fly at that low. But the engines, the RB211s that were allegedly on that plane, would have dug trenches on the way to the impact points in the building, which there weren't any, and there were no engines. So there's a number of problems with their whole story, and for it to get down that low, for the profile, it would have probably been impossible to clear the freeway overpass on the way in there to hit without significant issues before it got to the building. And the whole thing doesn't compute. But there's the issue with the story that doesn't work is that we know that the airplane allegedly clipped seven light poles on the way in, and 757, the preponderance of the fuel on board is in the wing structures, and that's where most of it would be. notwithstanding small amount that's not stored in the wings. And if you impact a light pole at 465 knots, which is at 350 was top speed at that altitude, because of the coefficient of parasite drag, which goes up by the cubed of the velocity. In other words, the faster you go, the more resistance you have because of parasite drag. The aircraft could never have achieved that speed under any circumstances after leveling off from the turn to reacquire the target. But the plane would have exploded. The wings would have hit the poles. There would have been massive explosions and fireballs. Large amounts of jet fuel spewed all over the lawn. The fireballs would have been visible for miles. But the fire that was visible from the Pentagon was dumpster fires, so as you well know, because you covered this and put it in stories. But it would have destroyed the wings on the 757 in such a way that it would have left major pieces of the wing long before the building. From the light pole strikes, it would have destroyed them. What did strike those poles was the Global Hawk drone that fired the missile, which had the effective wingspan to hit these poles in a way where they didn't have to sidestep back and forth to hit them on purpose. In other words, the Global Hawk had sufficient wingspan to strike those poles. Now, the Global Hawk does not store its fuel in the wing. Predominantly, the fuel storage in Global Hawk is real close to the center line of the aircraft, not in the wing structures. Incidentally, there was a piece of Global Hawk that was shown in a video where, on impact, it blew back, flew through the air, landed in the Sheraton DoubleTree parking lot. And on videotape, there's a security guard walks up to it, looks at it after he picks it up, and flings it. And it landed in a woman's car that had her sunroof open, and she didn't discover it till the next morning after she drove home. And then she presumed it was a part of American Airlines Flight 77, which it wasn't. It was part of the leading edge structure of a Global Hawk drone. And we have not only the video of this piece flying through the air back from the Pentagon, but we have a nice, heavy-duty, wonderful, bright-color photograph of it in the museum where they put this Global Hawk part, which shouldn't have been at the Pentagon and not in any way make or form at all, but yet it was. So they have another PR problem here. How do you explain the wreckage of a Global Hawk on 9/11 being picked up by a security guard and flung and presumed to be a part of a 757 when there's absolutely no part of a Boeing 757 that this fiberglass piece would look like? But being very familiar with what these drones look like, how they're constructed, this absolutely comes from a Global Hawk, and it comes from a wing structure approximately outboard enough to where when the explosion, when the impact happened with a light pole, that segment that was found by this woman, Peggy Elgas was her name, when she found it in her car, she didn't realize she had a Global Hawk part, wasn't a Boeing 757 part.
Dennis, let me turn it over to Giuseppe for further thoughts. That's all so detailed and convincing. Your thoughts, Giuseppe.
Well, first, it's wonderful to have the legendary Dennis Camino here on the show discussing the facts, because most facts when it comes to 9/11 are ignored because it's mass hypnosis. I mean, laying the groundwork for the mass hypnosis of the scamdemic today. But to me, the Frenchman Thierry Masson, who did the documentary that laid down the picture of what a 757 would look like, and then you saw pictures of when a plane hits a goose and the whole nose collapses, and it includes the ideas that the laws of physics were overwritten that day because a plane could not get that close to the ground, that plane rather. So what do you make of this mass hypnosis, Dennis? Why do so many people believe the obvious bullshit lies?
The thing that is more amazing to me, and it doesn't really shock me as much now 20 years later, but back then when it happened, when I was at Lockheed Martin talking about it with a guy named David Wagner, who we both worked in the test lab there, in Eagan, Minnesota. The thing that was so amazing to me is that people could believe that just any weenie who couldn't even rent a Cessna, a light aircraft under 2,500 pounds, Cessna 172, because they weren't confident enough to fly that, could jump into the cockpit, a complex airplane cockpit like this, and fly it with such precision. By the way, on the turn into the Pentagon for the flight data recorder data, the rudder pedals don't budge one inch, not even a centimeter. They're completely static. They're not moving. And even a neophyte had no flying experience at all. In order to maintain what's called perfect coordinated flight with the ball in the center on the slip skid indicator, even an experienced pilot would have had a hard time keeping that ball in the middle, but it was exactly perfectly centered with no rudder inputs whatsoever, which is nonsensical. A pilot would have had to use the rudders, and there was no rudder use whatsoever. That's very striking. There's a bunch of problems with that flight data recorder data, but for anybody that's ever flown anything and tried to pull a high G maneuver, by the way, this would have been approximately a 6G turn in a Boeing 757 at 465 knots, if we believe the ground track that it covered when you look at it, and the angle of bank that they would have had to maintain to do this. So they would have had what's called a compressor stall trying to go that fast down low with the airplane, obviously in a position where it would have had to periodically been slipped and skidded sideways on the flight path to keep it flying in a circle to get to the target. And compressor stalls, when they occur, you suddenly lose power and down you go. And airplane engines have a real big problem with air blockage in the inlets that causes compressor stalls. It can happen significantly down low when you're flying like they were that day. And the type of piloting that was apparently evident on this flight track that we saw on 9/11 would have made a lot of commercial airline pilots rather jealous relative to the precision. I don't know any pilot that could have maintained that tight circle to get to the Pentagon with no rudder inputs and keep the ball in the center. It would have been virtually impossible to do it. And controllability issues, aircraft at high speeds like that, are such that aileron control would have been problematic. There would have been any number of reasons why they would have probably started to shed parts once they got beyond 365, 370 on the way into the Pentagon, but no parts came off the airplane at all. There in the flight data recorder data, there was no stick shaker, there was no overspeed. Those are two things that would have been present with the airplane going faster than 350. So here again, there's things that were missing in the data that we have. The flight data recorder also proved that the cockpit door never opened during the so-called hijack time when the plane was hijacked. The interesting thing about airplanes flying at high altitudes at flight level 320 and 330, where this guy was at after it leveled off with the flight crew flying it, is that once it's up there, the speed between stall speed and cruise speed is very close together. We call it coffin corner for a number of different reasons. And any upset with the aircraft puts your airplane in a regime where you're instantly really out of control after the air autopilot disengages. And if you kill a crew member, by the way, by cutting his head off with box cutters, you now have a big problem getting him out of the seat, which with a guy like what they say Burlingame was, he may have even been fictional for all I can tell, a created person that never really existed. To get a guy that large physically out of the seat would have required a lot of effort, would have taken significantly more than 3 minutes, and during the struggle to kill him, he would have disengaged the autopilot, which put the airplane in an instant mode of being out of control. In such a bad way, by the way, that the neophyte pilots like these guys couldn't rent a Cessna 172 and fly it at an airport. They would have had a really hard time getting it back under control if they even did manage to get it under control. And I've cited this over and over again, that once you stall an airplane at high altitude, there's a number of reasons why you aren't going to really get it going again if the engines quit because the compressor stalls, which is a totally different issue, but could happen because of stall and loss of control at altitude. And the other thing that you have to do is usually you got to get yourself down to a lower altitude, like somewhere below 10,000 feet to even initiate a restart once the engines are flamed out. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why neophyte pilots wouldn't have been able to carry this out. But the most apparent thing that people, the average layman would never pick up on is immediately after they got control of the cockpits, they turned instantly on target and went directly to where they were going to hit these buildings. And these guys had already, the plane had already flown hundreds of miles out of the D.C. area and was radar vectored, by air traffic control, where you don't just do a 180-degree turn and go back to where you came from, because that does not work anymore. And the probability that they would have been at least 50 miles off by the time they turned around to get back there is great, because they would have had no knowledge at that level of expertise to reprogram the flight management system to put everything back in so that they could see the target in the flight management system after they turned around, because the plane was programmed to go to California. All the flight nav fixes in the flight path was already programmed for a flight that it was not going to do anymore. It was going back to where it came from. And it would have required maybe 15 minutes of hard work by experienced flight crew members to get the FMS hand programmed in the cockpit so it could go back to DC. An experienced pilot who's flown over PA and all these other places on the way probably would have been able to look out the nose and get himself there pretty good. But a neophyte guy that has no clue what he's doing would have had virtually no chance of getting 50 miles either side of the DC area properly. But yet they turned immediately perfectly on course, which is preposterous and ridiculous. The aircraft never went out of control after the autopilot would have been disengaged. There's a problem with the a number of things, like on the way, as you climb up to flight level 180, you set the altimeters with a push button, by the way, that sets both altimeters in the cockpit to 29.92 for vertical separation purposes. According to what we have, the flight crew would have done this, but there's no record of it in the flight data recorder data. On the way back down, by the way, as you come down through flight level 180, an experienced crew would once again set the altimeters, but not to 29.92, but to the barometric field elevation at Washington National, which is approximately where the target was, and this would have been done. So you'd have a good idea where you're at relative to the ground. Now, you'd argue that these guys didn't really care about that kind of precision because they're just going to whack a building, but you definitely would want the transponder to be on so other air traffic would be aware of your altitude as you're tooling along to maintain separation, because you don't want to get hit by another plane on the way in there. And apparently the transponder was allegedly switched off, so this wasn't there. There's other issues with the military. There's a prohibited area there that Mode 4 military transponder replies, which is encrypted. Civilian airliners can't reproduce it and transmit it. Would have been required to get anywhere near that area, and yet the airplane was allowed to proceed and penetrate it, which is absurd. They would have shot it down with air defense systems in the DC area, including in the building itself. So the skill level that was allegedly present for this crew, these neophyte hijackers, was exemplary, and there's no way in hell they could have done it. But the average person on the street in America believes that any guy on the street can jump in a cockpit, fly a complex airplane like this with a panel like that, with all glass panel predominantly, and navigate it. That's just ridiculous. But that's the kind of goofy stuff that the average public would believe, and it's completely ridiculous. And one more thing I want to point out is Rusty Amer with Rob Balsamo, who is a pilot for 9/11 Truth Person, who recently died of COVID. By the way, in the last couple months, and I want to mention him, even though I had virtually no use for him, I have to give him some credit. for the fact that the pilots for 9/11 truth proved when you put a guy with a trained cockpit, you know, pilot teaching, showing him how to fly the aircraft, it was virtually impossible for a neophyte to fly the airplane with any modicum of precision that would have been required to hit targets that day. And it was done over and over again. They couldn't do it. And so we have a number of reasons why the story of these Patsies, who really basically were found alive after 9/11, which is pretty good if you can respawn after you've hit buildings and crashed into things. They reported in, and I think it was it turned out that the main guy involved called his father to tell him that he was still alive the day after 9/11 happened. So I don't understand how Americans can think that a complex airliner cockpit is something that the average weenie can jump into and operate. That's preposterous. And by the way, I can take guys that have flown lesser aircraft and put them in an airplane of that weight class and capability, and they wouldn't be able to probably fly it with any degree of precision either. They're just not used to it. And a lot of people can argue with me, but Jesus Christ Almighty, it's absurd that people can believe the story, but yet they bought it. It's amazing.
Does that have any further thoughts?
Yes, I would like to share the information that Daryl Wayne, who is co-host with the great Rebel Madman Mike Gaddy on Revolution Radio shows Friday noon and Sunday 6 p.m. Eastern, at that time was a commercial airline pilot, a senior pilot for Midwest Airlines, and he was the first pilot to fly over the smoldering rubble and see that it was still molten. And since he was a senior pilot, he also trained people to fly the bigger jets. And so all the Midwest airline pilots couldn't believe the lies. So Daryl Wayne, who's going to be on this Saturday on Scorpio Show, and he can tell the whole story, but I'll make it short. Essentially, Daryl Wayne went in the simulator, which, as listeners may not know, when airlines train pilots, they have a very elaborate simulator that is just like flying a real plane. And the military does the same thing. They're you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, and it's programmed to rattle you and shake you, and the steering wheel or whatever you call that, it responds or won't respond. It's very real. And so Daryl tried to fly those maneuvers into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, couldn't do it. He had the top pilots attempt that in the simulator. No one, and these are the creme de la creme of commercial pilots at the time, no one could actually do those maneuvers.
Yeah, that's another good point. By the way, like I said, I think, you know, even though the Pentagon speed was ridiculous, the speed of 175 going into the South Tower was also ridiculous. It was like, you know, 512 knots, per what they said, you know, when they did analysis on the speed, which is preposterous. It couldn't do that. But the issue with the airplanes going fast is that you rapidly lose controllability because of airflow changes on the wing surfaces, even though they're swept. To be able to get pretty close to Mach 1, your typical cruise speed for most of these airplanes now is, for fuel efficiency reasons, is underneath 0.81, which is usually what, like, a 747, what I flew years ago, does at altitude. So, you know, being that the jet engines are so different from the JT-8s that were on those aircraft then, these are high bypass turbofans. They're rigged for fuel efficiency. They're very prone to compressor stalling when maneuvering happens in dense air. And the other, you know, issue that we know about it clearly on a cold morning like 9/11, below 1,000 feet, which is where you're at to strike the towers and hit the Pentagon, you're in cold dense air suddenly. You're not in, you know, really super cold air, which is very thin up high. You're in really thick, dense air. and a sudden change in the vehicle's yaw, you know, sideways movement through the air mass could compress or stall you in a heartbeat and render you with no power. So there's a number of things that are wrong with it, but the predominant one is the controllability of an airplane 100 knots on the other side of its maximum design limit at that altitude is so preposterously outside the realm of even an advanced pilot's skill range that it makes it problematic to be able to maintain control, especially in a tight turn where the lift and thrust vector has to be offset in a turn. And the load factor increases to where now the stall speed is a factor, even in a tight turn at high speed now, because the lift generation is should be directly up and down with gravity, and now you've offset it by anywhere between 45 to 90 degrees depending on the bank angle. So there's a lot of problems. For a neophyte to fly it in a 6G environment without being disoriented is preposterous, and that's what we had at the Pentagon. On 9/11, by the way, if you looked at the videos that fed, by the way, they used in the United States, all the video feeds were the same, which is kind of weird. But in Europe, the final trajectory for 175 going into the tower was a downward 30-degree nose-down dive approximately, which is not what we were shown in the United States. We were shown where a plane just pops into the frame and flies straight and level and smacks the tower. And the interesting thing is that the nose of the aircraft, the very first feed, showed the nose coming all the way out the other side and an engine flying out. Well, the engine that they found on the street underneath a scaffold, standing bolt upright, with a hand dolly next to it and a Dave Clark aviation headset, if you can believe that, was the wrong engine that the FBI brought in a panel truck and dropped off there, and then scurried away and left. They planted an engine that would have only been used it was the same model number, JT9, but it was a JT9D model, which hadn't been installed in anything but older 747s. It never was installed in the 757 model and 767 models that were involved that day. And the thing that identified the engine is a cooling duct that's visible on the top of the aircraft engine as it sits bolt upright underneath a scaffold, in New York City on Church and Murray. Another issue that most people weren't aware of is that they planted a piece of landing gear that was lowered with a rope which was still attached to it when it was recovered.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening. Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it, that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, that Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back to hour two of the event, the only weekly simulcast on Revolution Radio featuring the Wisdom Circle from Studio A and the Raw Deal, Jim Fetzer's magnificent platform on Studio B. And so, Dennis, there are so many insane lies. This is probably a tough question that weave the fictional narrative of 911. In your mind, what should be the most ridiculous lie that it would have shocked people into understanding that this never happened the way it's reported and purported?
Well, the biggest thing that they put out was that they lost radar contact of Flight 77 out over Ohio, over a mountainous area where there was a 3D air search radar called an FPS-117, which is a 250 nautical mile range radar, which is in service that day. And even if it was in what they call reduced capability mode, it would attract the plane turning around and returning back to DC, and they would have never lost radar contact. But the drama that Leon Mineta had done with the range call outs about the plane coming back, and it was Flight 77. They had no way of knowing what it was because there was no re-identification capability. The FAA, if you lose comms, they can give you instructions if you can receive audio and maybe not transmit, but if the pilots would have been listening on the frequency, if it would have been real pilots, not hijackers, they would have been able to maintain control of the aircraft by re-identifying with ATC if they fell off a radar, which it didn't. But The official story is that, that this airplane was positively re-ID'd as Flight 77, which is preposterous because it doesn't follow protocols for air traffic control identification of an airplane, even in what's called NORDO, no radio contact with the plane. They didn't do that. And it was allowed to fly all the way back into D.C. without being intercepted and or shot down on the way in, because the prohibited area inside of the D.C. area would have mandated a shoot down with no Mode 4. I don't care if it's an airliner or whatever it was, it would have been brought down because of the high value of the targets that it would have been possibly striking. It would have killed civilians to prevent it from hitting those buildings. They didn't do that. But the other issue is the no interception thing is very problematic in the sense that all the interceptors that were left over, they were pre-positioned in everywhere but the East Coast on purpose in preparation to keep them out of the area for use. But the few that were left were vectored out over the ocean and forced to circle out over the sea off the east coast of the United States, so they couldn't come in and identify, you know, these planes and force them to not hit targets or shoot them down. And they were not allowed to even play that day, which is preposterous. They would have been. But as you might be aware, there was an order that was issued by Dick Cheney to change the protocols for the authority that the aircraft commanders had as interceptors to deal with them. I'm going to sneeze, so excuse me, I had to cover my microphone a little bit. But that doesn't work. The other, you know, the total lack of intercepts on these aircraft is a big thing. But the thing we haven't talked about is the fact that the timing of everything. North American Air Defense Systems had no phone communications out of Cheyenne Mountain on 9/11. Their phone system was inoperative. And for that to occur would have required somebody, you know, from Inkytel, you know, from the Israeli telephone system to shut it off so that nobody in NORAD could communicate, and that's what they did. They weren't able to pick up a telephone and dial out on 9/11. There's, people think that Osama bin decomposing could disable the phone system at NORAD from Tora Bora. They're more delusional than I want to believe them to be, but most Americans are so delusional that they didn't really care about the fact that no intercepts occurred, and they would have occurred. They would have been multiple intercepts. And there's a reason why they couldn't allow these aircraft to be intercepted. And the fundamental reason is that much of what was seen on 9/11 was unprecedented, in the sense that false target generation was displayed in the Northeast Air Defense Sector radar scopes, and it would have never been allowed to be displayed to FAA air traffic control personnel because it would have caused massive confusion and potential for mid-air collisions. In other words, air safety is primary. I don't care what they want to do with the drill. The number of different drills, Vigilant, Dildo, or whatever they called it, and all these other, you know, something, Amalgam, and all these other things that they were running on 9/11, they were all you know, in place. And of course, the excuse that everybody used is, well, the FAA didn't know what was real and what was not. But what we found through examination with a guy named Blue Collar Republican that I worked with during analysis of the flight data recorder positional data, is that the data was off in position by 26.7 seconds. And of course, the public doesn't really care about this, but there's a big issue with this in the sense that for the radar data to be so skewed in time and not be accurate is not real, because all equipment racks and all DOD facilities use cesium beam ion clock time synchronization. It's all synced up with WWV in the D.C. area. It would have been from the Naval Observatory there, right there locally. But there's no way that there would have been a 26.7 second disparity in positioning. And on 9/11, the reason why they couldn't allow interceptors to be potentially radar vectored to these targets is they would have flown to where the targets were, and there would have been nothing. There would have been no airliner. And the reason why is that much of what was being displayed for 9/11 was recorded on a device called SPH-1 or SPH-2. I worked on this device on the USS Truxton in the 1970s, and it was a radar recorder reproducer that the military had capability of. And they removed the one from the USS Truxton. I don't know where it went after it went, but it was designed and built by Johns Hopkins University and allowed the military to pre-record scenarios and replay them on radar systems. And much of what occurred on 9/11 because of the 26.7 second offset was necessary for the offset, because they had to mix the radar, live radar targets, back with recorded, pre-recorded video from prior exercise, which, by the way, they flew a year before using a Boeing 757 flying over the Pentagon so low that it rattled a building. But my supposition is that the consistent 26.7 second delay was two FPS-117 radar sweeps, which allowed the operators, the Israeli operators, and the E-4Bs over Washington, D.C., over Arlington, and over New York City, two separate E-4Bs, by the way, that were under lease by the Israeli Air Force on 9/11. They were the command and control for 9/11, and they were the ones that had to call out targets that they didn't want to be seen on the radar systems and make it so that people couldn't see them. But interceptor pilots would have flown to where these recorded targets where they would have seen no planes. And the reason why I know this for a fact is that on 9/11, there was a guy in November 602, Papa, who was in a Piper Aerostar that was in the airspace with Flight 77. And air traffic control was telling him, you know, your target is like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, you know, X miles. The separation vertically and the distance between these two aircraft, I'm going to tell you from personal experience that there's no way on this planet that the Aerostar pilot would not positively have seen Flight 77 in the sky coming at him the opposite direction. And yet it wasn't there. And air traffic control was calling it out to him, and he was looking for it and couldn't see it. Now, I'm not saying that all pilots have wonderful vision, but on a clear day, ceiling and visibility unlimited, or CAVU that day, it would have been impossible for this pilot not to see it, but yet he did not see it, and he was interviewed by the FBI. He's another important piece of this puzzle. And the reason why I give him mention is that he died in an unfortunate accident not too very long after 9/11 happened, and he had his little interview with the FBI, at which time they found out that he could not, after looking all over the sky, could not see Flight 77, though it was in his airspace and coming right at him. Now, not saying that absolutely cinches it, but the thing that absolutely cinches the use of recorded video being replayed on 9/11 is the 26.7 second delay, which when we talked to the public affairs officer, Andrew, who was a female captain, about how this can be, she had no response to me when I said that there's a cesium beam ion atomic clock feed to every one of your equipment racks at Andrews, just like all military bases. And there's no way that the radar picture could be so skewed in time. It would have to be absolutely on time to negate the probability of massive numbers of near misses and mid-air collisions. It would have possibly almost occurred on 9/11 if they would have delayed it any more than two, which is 11.5 second sweeps, which is exactly what we had with the 26.7 second delay, gave the Israeli operators and the E-4Bs plenty of time to take out targets that they didn't want to be seen, which would be the E-4Bs, which never were on radar, but they were visually seen by naked eyeballs on the ground in both locations, orbiting high over both locations. So how could they be flying over New York City and over Arlington that day without being on radar? Very good question, but they were pulled out. And my supposition is that they used a data link from the E-4B to ship the video down to ground stations and plummet in. And by the way, multiple air traffic control specialists asked for the false target generation to cease because it was causing major problems. And it would have been in an exercise environment, the minute the real world stuff happened, it would have been turned off. And yet it persisted for almost an hour after everything stopped, which is absolutely ridiculous. But they never, never in a million years would have allowed the FAA to plumb in exercise video like this with multiple false targets into air traffic control radar systems because of the collision problem, and they allowed that to happen. So the American public's not aware of this 26.7 second delay and the fact that this Piper Aerostar pilot, which is a pretty experienced airman in that Piper Aerostar, that they couldn't see this airplane because it wasn't there. And if the interceptors would have gone to intercept these guys, they would have gone to places where there was no airliner because they weren't in the sky in that spot. But there's one more thing that we haven't mentioned yet, is that these aircraft were equipped with what's called ACARS, which is a data link system. And there was a gentleman named Ballinger, who was a dispatcher from United Airlines, who had the original readouts from his data terminal, which proved that the two United aircraft involved in the 9/11 were still in the sky after the destruction, and their data links were still working and transmitting data real time to radio ground stations, or RGSs for ACARS, after their destruction, which is a pretty good trick if you can discombobulate an aircraft.
Up tower down.
Go ahead, Jim.
For the audience. Yeah.
So anyway, the
planes, but we were told the Twin Towers collapsed when they're so grossly different than what happened in Building 7, which without any doubt did collapse. You've done brilliant work on how they were destroyed. Talk about what happened to the Twin Towers.
What basically had to happen for the Twin Towers to not come down in what I call an asymmetric collapse under any circumstances. And it's preposterous to believe that the buildings, which were designed to withstand multiple airplane strikes, by the way, came down in their own footprint on 9/11, you know, inside of an hour after being hit, allegedly. And as you can imagine, 47 thick steel core support columns in the cores of these buildings had to be physically removed and out of the way for the buildings to fall in a free fall fashion, which they did. And people haven't really looked at the wreckage closely, but by the way, all these core support columns were cut in angular cuts from thermite charges at exactly 53 foot lengths. And this was done on 9/11. This wasn't done to remove the wreckage post 9/11. This was done with the demolition. In other words, all of the support columns were cut to get out of the way to allow for the implosion. But there was a massive amount of vermiculite, which is basically, asbestos-laden slurry that's significantly lighter for obvious reasons, that was in the floor panels for the World Trade Center. And that was pulverized on 9/11 to the degree that it was fine dust in a giant cloud. We did the volcano, World Swirling in a Volcano of Lies article about how ludicrous it was. But the vermiculite was pulverized, and for it to be so pulverized required a lot more force than what even thermite charges that cut the columns could do. And therefore, the issue had to have been that they used at least one nuclear device low in the buildings in each tower to using the sequence detonation of the detonation charges around the core of the device to focus the energy like a Claymore mine, like a shaped charge, upwards to clean out the core of the building, while the significant part of the steel structure around it acted like a Faraday cage to fundamentally suppress most of the electromagnetic pulse energy from a nuclear blast that would have destroyed radios probably for about a 10-mile radius around the buildings because of the blasts themselves. And for the longest time, I did not believe that nuclear devices were used until I saw proof of the Compton electron effect from nuclear detonation with the United 175 tower, South Tower being destroyed, where a helicopter flying about 3.5-4 miles away was in the air, and then the helicopter was struck by the EMP pulse. And it broke the sync on the video in exactly the way you'd expect it if you've worked with the equipment, as I did at White Sands Missile Range, that is designed to withstand electromagnetic pulse stuff and be able to handle it. But I'm very familiar with what that Gaussian noise also sounds like on a radio. And on 9/11, all the radio squelches in the general area were broken with a Gaussian squelch break that really sounds pretty much like a low-yield nuke in the cases of what we had for the demolition of at least one tower, for sure. But the recording that I hadn't seen for a great number of time absolutely certifies the use of a low-yield nuke to destroy one of the two towers, and if they used it for one, it's a surety that they used it for both. And the issue with the destruction is that under any circumstances, even a company called Controlled Demolition Incorporated, who is expert technology for this kind of destruction, would have probably had a real hard time guaranteeing that the collapse didn't go asymmetrical and to the side. And if you remember any of the footage that we were shown, which predominantly is not real anyway, the one tower started to visibly break and go sideways for a significant amount of time before it suddenly disintegrated and didn't do anything. And that's very problematic in the sense that with all that mass, as you might imagine, Jim, and you're very well aware of it, when controlled demolition occurs, the rubble pile, even with the bathtubs, it would have contained a significant portion of it, would have been so high that it would have been several stories above the ground level after the collapse, and that wasn't really the case. And what we had was a rubble pile that was significantly not as tall. And vermiculite, which was completely pulverized and not in major chunks and floor panels, but it was completely, totally pulverized.
Controlled demolition. So you have a residue, a pile that would be equal to about 12% of the original height. In the case of the 47 floor building 7, that turned out to be about 5.5 floors with 110 story twin towers. It should have been 13.5. I had a Episcopal priest, Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Church in the vicinity, a first responder, on my show twice. And both times he emphasized those buildings were destroyed to or even slightly below ground level.
Yeah, and the issue here, like I said, is that for so much steel to be gone, as in like missing, it would have had to have been destroyed by neutron bombardment, which really will demolecularize steel to the point where it renders it into small particles. It doesn't allow it to stay in a steel matrix any longer. And a significant amount of that happened even in Japan when we bombed the two cities there, even though you could see a lot of steel structures because the device went off so high up, not inside a building, actually. So, excuse me, I'm going to cough again. the dearth of steel in the collapse is really the other key. That the only way to dispose of that much steel and pulverize it to the degree where it becomes dust is to use nuclear effects, and you couldn't do that with explosives alone. For that kind of rapid oxidation and demolecularization to occur in steel requires radiation of a moderately high level. You can't do it with a major fire, and there would have been so much more wreckage that to get out of the way as the buildings collapse would have been impossible. It would have delayed the collapse and made it even much more prolonged during the collapse, but we know both buildings came down in free fall, which means all the material underneath completely got out of the way of what was coming down from above, and that's unprecedented for such tall structures. And So the dearth of material, the fact that the rubble heap was not as high as it should have been, the amount of steel that was removed from the site in the aftermath, all points to nuclear detonations in both buildings to effectively hollow out the cores. And like I said, the buildings themselves acted like Faraday cages to suppress the EMP pulse so it didn't destroy radios for a great distance away from there. And that's one of the reasons why jerk-offs like Richard Gage and his ilk from AE-911 never wanted any of the goddamn dust from any of the windows in Manhattan to be tested in a lab via gas chromatograph, because it would have showed all the constituents of nuclear detonation inside of it. But they prevented this over and over again by saying, oh, after time it would have changed. But certain things don't change. and the reason that never once did a sample go to a gas chromatograph anywhere, not once. And that's absurd. That's ridiculous. So they hung everything out on this limited hangout thermite thing is the sole method, although thermite was used to cut those support columns so they could be trucked out of there pretty quick in the aftermath. Thermite couldn't have possibly pulverized these buildings to the degree that what was it, 280,000 tons of vermiculite would be reduced to fine powder. That couldn't be done by thermite. No way on this planet.
Yeah, that's great stuff, Dennis. Great stuff. And of course, Steve Jones has promoted the nanothermite based on a tiny number of dust samples from an apartment in the vicinity. But the U.S. Geological Survey conducted dust surveys from 35 different locations and found a host of elements that would not have been present had this not been a nuclear event. Barium, strontium, lanthanum, lithium, some of which only exist in radioactive form. This is where Judy Wood abandoned science by ignoring these results, being unwilling to revise her hypothesis of the use of dews when it became overwhelmingly obvious that nukes could explain everything hypothesis could, and many other issues her dew hypothesis could not.
Yeah, there's been a number of disinformation campaigns, Woods being one of them, but this other one was the photographer that he was another, I call him a shimmer, he was a false prophet that FEMA had at the site that allegedly was being investigated for having murdered his wife and all that. You know, they always create this intriguing story to get you to bite the bait and take it, but he ended up reporting that there was X, Y, and Z aircraft stuff present. And the thing that's amazing is that even if these buildings completely fell into their own footprints, the constituent components of a 100-ton airliners would have still been in the wreckage no matter what. Yes, that because we saw fireballs, which were predominantly artificial and CGI-generated, that they would have been there, but for the lion's share of these planes to not exist, and for them to be forced to plant the wrong engine and drop, you know, a landing gear component on a rope in the location, kind of says that you wouldn't need to do that if you had real airplane parts. And the 100-foot section of the nose of 175 coming out the other side of the building, which they ultimately got out of the feeds later by putting a black bar over it to hide it, would have landed in the street. There would have been bodies and aircraft rubble right on the street itself, and that wasn't there at all. It was completely missing in action because that section of nose, after it came out the other side, just evaporated, which everybody knows that metal airplanes evaporate when they go through the air, and that's how they really do it. So, you know, here I am using some sarcasm to talk about how preposterous it was, but when they did the CGI generation, they forgot to give the guy that did it some guidelines and say, an aluminum frangible airplane can't go through 47 core columns, come out the other side intact without the nose being blunted, and then disappear before it hits the street. So, I mean, there would have been a huge amount of wreckage, real wreckage, and bodies and things that would have not been contained in the buildings. Plus, the other issue is that significant parts of the planes would have not penetrated the building because of the steel exoskeleton around it would have prevented entry. And those would have been found in the street in New York City around the perimeter, and that wasn't there. So we have a lot of clues that airplanes weren't used. But one of the things I want to mention before we get too far off and I'll forget about it is that all the eyewitnesses that said that they saw this plane and this plane and this plane all worked for the networks, were all Jewish, and then significantly weren't in a physical position to actually see the aircraft strike happen because they were blocked by other buildings. They couldn't see it from their locations. But ear witness accounts of people on the street heard a high screech sound. And if you've ever listened to a Glickham or, you know, a ground-launched cruise missile flying at 500 knots, which is what they do down low, they make the Williams turbofan, the 731 model that was in Glickham's, it makes a high-pitched screech that's unmistakable. If you've ever heard it, you'd recognize it forever. And that's what people were hearing. They weren't hearing the low growl of RB211s or CFM engines that down low in dense air would have been growling at a very low pitch on their way to the buildings, even at high speeds. And that was missing. That was completely not there. But the high-pitched screeches were heard by people that couldn't see anything. And, of course, you're very well aware of the fact that the Nadi brothers happened to have their camera perfectly positioned in the street during an episode where they videographed the impact of the one building. Just by accident, they just happened to be in place. And components of this airplane disappear and don't exist for portions in time before the impact, which is pretty good. But if you look at the trajectory and everything and the angle, you can actually see where the slots of the building entry were actually added. And they really don't match the wing dihedral. And there's no engine penetration points. And like I said, the engine that you see flying out of the side of the building, which is ridiculous, that allegedly lands in the street and ends up next to a handcart, standing bolt upright in the wrong engine.
Nanogram of the street they were on, Dennis, was they were on Duane Street, and they just rearranged the ladder to create Nade.
Yeah, it's and the thing is that the number of people that really saw anything, that was actionable that day is preposterous. It's, in other words, Manhattan, if you've ever been down there during the rush hour period, it's much more populated than it was on 9/11. It was virtually a ghost town. And it's because it was really cordoned off as an elaborate movie set. And for Barry Jennings' observation when he was walked through the lobby of the World Trade Center to get him out of the building, walking past everything, he stepped over dead bodies and things that happened at before the buildings collapsed. And for the lobbies to be destroyed and dead people to be laying around there meant that it couldn't possibly have been a result of airplane impacts under any circumstances. It's preposterous.
That was inside Building 7, where he'd gone to Rudy Giuliani's command and control center to with her own daughter and found half-eaten sandwiches, still steaming cups of coffee, and a fireman came along and said, "We got to get out of here." Explosions were taking place. This was in the morning. Itself, as you say, stepping over dead bodies, which he couldn't see when he got out. He reports, some of which may still be available online. Absolutely right.
Yeah, that there's so many parts of this that doesn't compute, but the public believed it because they thought that neophytes could fly these planes with precision. They believed that the planes could cause such massive damage in buildings that were designed to withstand multiple airplane strikes from any number of different directions. They believed the bullshit that the fire heated up the steel enough to cause it to collapse. All these things that are so ridiculous and preposterous. Even the crap that NIST put out about the collapse is so ridiculous and stupid that it defies logic and science. So virtually every component of the whole entire United States apparatus was in on the cover-up of the fakery, and it's shameful for the rest of the world, by the way, for guys like Kerry Mison and these other people in other countries to see the preposterousness of it. And yet Americans, knee-deep in this thing, we're listening to Lee Greenwood and Toby Keith and their ass-kicking shit and getting spooled up around their flags when clearly this couldn't have been carried out by a bunch of guys, you know, from Tora Bora. And they were unaware of the fact that NORAD had no phone capability of any kind to call out with and talk to anybody on a telephone. And if anybody believes that people in the caves in Tora Bora could disable NORAD's phone system on 9/11 and cause a 26.7-second delay and false targets and all this other stuff and no intercepts, all these things could be done by guys in Afghanistan. Then they deserve what they get, in a country because they're so stupid that science doesn't register in their brain and they buy simplified and preposterous explanations about what couldn't possibly have happened on 9/11. And now we're 20 years out, and the most astonishing thing is that people probably know less about 9/11 today because of the endless propaganda and re-propaganda over and over again today than they did 5 years after it happened. And I was hopeful at one point that because we had up to like 60% of the population smelling a rat with all the truth work that we did, that it was actually gone backwards from there and that the IQs in America have dropped so much in 20 years that that most people actually don't want to believe the truth and they'll accept the official story because it's the most comfortable thing to believe. Because it's hard to want to believe that your government is so intrinsically evil that they would carry out an operation like this for a number of reasons, fundamentally for Israel, because Israel was in the driver's seat in the two E-4Bs flying them over Arlington and over New York City that day. And there's no constructive reason why the U.S. Air Force would allow U.S. Air Force personnel to not be in these aircraft operating them and to have Israeli pilots flying them and Israeli operators at the operator stations in these things without a great deal of pre-planning and a purpose in mind. In other words, it's not viable or something that can be sold that on this particular day that the Israelis would be in these aircraft operating them on 9/11 just by coincidence. It doesn't work like that. So it gave the United States government a great deal of plausible deniability. A great deal of misinformation and disinformation was put out by guys like Gage and his ilk from AU-911, Wayne Conti, another one of them, about planes being at the Pentagon that really weren't. The plane that was at the Pentagon was the 1995 Booger crash, and there wasn't enough of it brought in to make it plausible for it to be a reality. They obviously couldn't synthesize the death. And by the way, during the trial of the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, the government presented in a courtroom pictures of the corpses from Flight 77, and they were all intact in orange jumpsuits, and they weren't burnt, and they weren't dismembered. They were all in one piece. And for an airplane to strike the building at 465 knots, those bodies would have been dismembered absolutely positively. So I don't know where they got the corpses from and put them in jumpsuits or if they even used dead people, but for them to put crap like that in the courtroom and stage another hoax, which, by the way, is preposterous that the guy would go to a flight school and tell people that he only wanted to fly straight and level, unless it was part of the grandiose bullshit story that made Americans believe that neophytes like this could fly these planes, which is impossible. Especially when they respond and were alive days after the event anyway. So all of these elements of it, the disinformation campaign by the Central Intelligence Agency in the aftermath was very successful. 20 years later, like I said, more of the population believes it now than they did after it happened. So we went backwards.
No coincidence that the mainstream media is dominated by dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. I have a panel of 100 executives with CNN, every one of whom is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. A panel of 100 executives from NBC, everyone is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. Another 100 executives from the New York Times, every one of whom is a dual Israeli citizen. So they seem to have a lock on our media and can feed us any long shit. And it seems to be taken at face value by a highly gullible, unsophisticated American public.
Yeah, the American public never got a chance to listen to the account of a gentleman that worked at the cemetery at Arlington that was interviewed by the National Archives personnel that went and talked to him in person. But if you're unaware of the fact that there was a gang called Citizens Investigation Group, or CIT, that went and interviewed people at the gas station, they proved that a flyover took place on 9/11. The plane did what's called a low approach. It overflew the building and banked off and went away. A part that we have not yet covered, and I want to cover it before we get too much deeper into this, is that a C-130 hotel model was the final guidance for the Global Hawk and the firing of the Maverick, and it circled the Pentagon, and it was flown by an Air Force Commander O'Brien, who was the pilot in that airplane. And the C-130H model is equipped where a Milvan type of special equipment, electronic warfare equipment, or whatever you want to shove into the back of it and plug into the plane, would allow a drone control module to be shoved into the ass end of it and used to control the RQ-4 Global Hawk and the Maverick on the way into the building. And O'Brien lied about his position relative to the Pentagon, but his radar track puts him right on top of the building at a time when he couldn't possibly have a legitimate reason to be there. Because as you might imagine, at a point like this, even a military airplane would have been well advised not to be right on top of it unless it was a fighter that was protecting it. And most people weren't aware of the fact that in the United States that the Cheney, I call it the Cheney gang, purposely moved in advance all the fighter assets into Canada and places far away from the Northeast Air Defense Sector prior to the exercises that they did that day to cover their tracks. So there would have been a huge number of airplanes that would have been able to stop this stuff in its tracks if it wasn't pre-positioned out of the spot. And like I said, there's so many things the American public didn't know. They weren't aware of the fact that communications at NORAD were completely shut off, and a lot of the parts of the story didn't compute. And eyewitnesses that were looking at the Pentagon, like the Spec 4 that took pictures of it, saw no wreckage there. Jamie McIntyre said that there's no evidence of a plane impact. The dumpster fires that Americans weren't aware of that were lit to generate the thick black smoke from the jet fuel in the dumpsters. But they were really there. They were used to generate the ruse. And a lot of photography that shows that FBI personnel were actively involved in moving wreckage away from the building and out onto the lawn. We have pictures of this going on. And in a crash situation like that, the only time that you're allowed to move wreckage is if you have to move emergency equipment in, and they would have been able to get around it because there were so few pieces of it. So that's not a problem. But yet you have pictures of FBI personnel hand-carrying wreckage and placing it. And this is just, all these things are unknown by the public. And the fact that the aircraft were in the FAA registry for more than 3 years after their alleged destruction is also preposterous, because once you'd identify wreckage and compare it to trailing documents of the aircraft production to provide that it really is what it's supposed to be, then you strike it from the registry. And this didn't happen until a number of us called out the fact that these airplanes were still in service, and they wouldn't be because they'd be destroyed. So we have a lot of things that public did not know, and the fact that Building 6 was completely hollowed out and destroyed, and in a way that indicates that something major happened there that no aircraft impact could possibly do. But it was like somebody scooped it out with a giant ice cream scoop and totally, completely cleaned it out. It's gone. How could that have been? You know, I mean, there's so many things, parts of the story that don't work. But from any number of reasons, the bare minimum, 98% of the population, if they actually had any brains, couldn't possibly buy it, but they don't, and they don't believe the official story. And
Giuseppe, I want to get back into the game here. Dennis had so many fascinating things to say, but I know you have thoughts and questions to add.
Dennis, I'm struck by the amazing parallels in the mass hypnosis of 9/11 and the current mass hypnosis with the scamdemic and the driving the sheeple to take the death jab. What are your thoughts on the idea that 9/11 laid the groundwork for an even bigger scam, which is now the COVID scam?
Well, like I said, the biggest issue is cognitive dissonance, and the problem that it's a big obstacle is that even when your lying eyeballs are telling you something that's contrary to what the official story is, over time, because it's so horrible and so ugly to believe what your lying eyeballs are telling you, what your gut tells you, in time the bullshit will seep into the point where you'll just arbitrarily go, yeah, okay, they would not be lying to me, so I got to believe them. And because Americans are bereft of a scientific background or an aeronautical background and haven't flown heavy aircraft and have no idea what the air traffic control system does and how it works and all these different things, that today the narrative is significantly simpler than the 9/11 narrative. It's you know, this cootie is there, it'll kill you, so you better get that jab. And the biggest problem that I have with what's going on now is that significantly large numbers of health workers, nurses and doctors are saying, no, I'm not going to do it. And a person has to ask themselves, why? You know, I mean, is this just because they're all Republicans and they're going to do the contrary thing? I don't think it's that simple. But that's the narrative that they're being told on mainstream media day in and day out. It's these anti-vaxxers are Republicans and they're evil and they're all Trumpers and they're all this and they're all that. The narrative is a divide and conquer tool. And I guess it was NBC just recently did a story where it was the anti-vaccination thing is changing the way people interact with each other. And absolutely, positively it is. And the reason why is it's a psychological game that's being played that's pitting approximately 50% of the population of the country, which are not all Republicans. They're not. That are not getting the jab. They're doctors and they're nurses and they're policemen. Policemen are saying, no, we're not going to do it. And not saying that cops are the brightest light bulbs on the string, cause they're really not. You can't be a bright person and be a cop for a bunch of reasons. And I have an anti-law enforcement bias per the Paul Tashita from the Department of Public Safety of Minnesota told me that when I did a radar story about the cops' improper use of radar for revenue generation. But if you have a working brain, it either takes extreme dedication, which I can't count out, or stupidity to want to put your life at risk for people that either have no appreciation for the dynamic of the work. And I don't, because I've only seen predominantly the bad side of them, although I have met good ones, and one in Minnesota for sure. But in 66 years, I can count all the good encounters on one hand and have fingers left over. And that's amazing. But those guys are saying no to it. So do you want to believe that the doctors and the nurses and all the I call them donut guards, all of them are stupid and ignorant and they're doing it because they're Republicans? Well, that's the narrative. That's what mainstream media is putting out, that they're all Trumpers and therefore they're not going to take the jab because they're all Republicans. And that's a very simplistic and Pollyannish and stupid way to look at it. But when you have doctors that have been PhD physicians, not just a regular ER doctor, but guys that are specialists that are saying, no, I don't want mRNA DNA in my body. I don't want, mRNA, anything in my body. I don't want this other crap in my body. When they're rejecting it offhand, for good reason, because, you know, stroke and heart, you know, issues and paralysis and all these other problems that the mainstream media is denying is occurring in the population. People are getting sick and dying from it. Now, arguably, you know, with any kind of medical procedure, there's a lack of perfection, just like any other human endeavor. But there's been sizable numbers of people on virtually every continent that's been getting the jabs that are dropping dead 2 weeks after they get the shots. And it's not by some weird coincidence. And it's not because they're all fat people that have diabetes either. You know, in one particular case, a woman got the jab, and within hours, she was with a debilitating neurological disease that prevented her from being able to walk. I mean, Jesus Christ Almighty! You can mainstream media the shit out of people, but until they see one of their children die or a relative of theirs die from the jab, which isn't going to happen enough for people to be convinced. But if it did, they'd be angry and pissed off. And I've stated before on another show that if I had a child that was still alive, which I don't, and they died from this shit, I'd go kill the doctor that administered it.
Yep.
I don't give a shit. And the reason why is it's murder. And for the pharmaceutical companies to be able to get completely off the hook for the liability for it is preposterous. And the risk of taking the vaccine, in my opinion, greatly, vastly outweighs the risk of dying from it. And not saying that people don't die from it, because I'm quite convinced that people, and Jim, you know that you got quite sick even though you recovered. But I recovered, and other people that have had COVID have died, but I recovered, and I'm not like the pinnacle of health, but I try and take better care of myself. But by far and by large, the lethality of COVID versus the risk factor, there's a big gulf in the middle of this, and that's why police officers and nurses and doctors are saying no. And that's why approximately 50% of the population who aren't Republicans ostensibly are saying no. So they have a hidden agenda, and what that agenda is yet to be fully determined. But I think for the most part, it's twofold. It's control, and then secondarily, it's a depopulation agenda. And it's been very successful so far to divide and conquer America. And what wasn't accomplished during the Trump administration in division has only been enhanced by what the pandemic has caused. And no one can dispute that the fact that Trump couldn't possibly have engineered this. You know, I mean, I don't like him even a little bit. But if anybody wants to hang this on Trump's head, they're delusional, and they're fucked up in the skull to deal to put it on him when he couldn't possibly have done it. So you can't blame it on him, and therefore, you know, who's behind it? Well, I mean, think about this: that at one particular time in America, we once were in a position where the military industrial complex was the ones that made the lion's share of the profits. But now, because America's weapon systems are so known to be faulty and not working, America can't, with a great deal of success, sell weapons anymore. So now the only thing that can export to these gullible countries is tons of this crap that they put in vials and ship everywhere. And if you believe the narrative that they can maintain the strict temperature control in the transfer of this stuff globally, then I got some bridges for you down to Florida. Because it's preposterous. But yet people want to believe, because like I said, the cognitive dissonance is strong, and it makes it impossible for people to allow their higher reasoning skills, which we're all born with, but taken away from us through time, through propaganda, to kick in and say, something's wrong with this picture. And we're at a juncture in time as a species on this planet where people's belief in the government is justifiably sullied for any number of reasons. But it's very heartening to me to see, as of like 2 days ago, in places like France and Belgium and the Netherlands, that literally tens of thousands of people are in the streets about this this green pass crap and the vilification of people that won't get the jab. And I think that's very encouraging. And the reason why I say that is that my observation of Europeans, having lived amongst them for a number of years when I was younger, was that they were not stupid. They were quite bright, and most of them achieve a much higher level of education than the average person in America, and they're usually probably less likely to be fooled. And that's where the differences lie. In America, people are dumber than dirt and can't even pour piss out of a boot with instructions on the sole. And I don't say that lightly. I think that the dumbing down process has been very successful via the Talmud vision and the mainstream media. The endless bombardment of bullshit and crap has made Americans extremely susceptible to propaganda and stupid. And unfortunately for us, it'll be our downfall. To be able to place any trust in a government that overwhelmingly gets a not even an F but an F minus grade for believability with all the crap it's pulled since the killing of JFK in Dealey Plaza in 1963, which, by the way, was the penultimate false flag by the CIA, and they got away with that. So 9/11 was child's play, and pandemic's child's play in comparison. And where we're at now is that we're at extreme risk of even more preposterous crap in the midst of the economic collapse.
Vacation of what you're talking about. Robert David Steele was former CIA, who recently expired after going into a hospital, a very sad story. Was being vilified as a conspiracy theorist when he worked for the CIA, for God's sake, which conducts conspiracies, overthrows the governments, assassinations, false flag all over the world. How dumb is that, Dennis?
Well, you know, most people are unaware of the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald has a gold star in the lobby in Langley. You know, and the reason why is that even the monstrous scum in Jewry that run this country through the Pentagon and through London have to pay homage to the patsies that they used to promote their social engineering and their crap that they pull. And people will denounce me for having said it, but the people that work in the Beltway in Langley are the biggest traitors on this earth, because they've sold their country down the toilet for Jewish control. And it happened in 1948 when the OSS was morphed into the CIA, and that's been the de facto control.
Probably in relation to the observance of the assassination you're addressing right now, on which you've done brilliant work as well. I can't thank you enough, Dennis. Today is sensational. Giuseppe, your thoughts?
Dennis hopefully will be joining us, Jim, on Scorpio's Return, the 3-hour 9/11 show. So perhaps if you have time, Dennis, we'll address more of this Saturday.
Sure. I mean, we could talk about these things, 9/11 for 2 or 3 days. But the biggest problem is that we're going to overwhelm people because their attention span is in nanoseconds, and we cover stuff that takes longer than that.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
So, can you guys hear me?
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict.